Today is March 30th, 2008. You're listening to truthlovefreedom.org. And I'm your host, So Real. I have a person to introduce once again. He's back. He moved away for a little while, but he missed me, so he had to come back.
It's true.
We have Justin back with us, and he's going to be co-hosting for a while here with us, I guess, until he decides to abandon me again.
Yeah, sure. Or you move away.
Yeah, one or the other. We'll see what happens. So, I don't even think you can hear me there. Okay. So, we're back with another podcast. This is Podcast 10. Thanks to everybody who's been sending me emails saying what's up, and, you know, they wanted me to throw down another podcast. Sorry, I've been lagging. You know, I've been, you know, in my own little world, of course, as usual. It's just staying true to form. It's getting them out maybe like once or twice a year. This is a song I found online on accident. I just wanted to share it with you because it has a lot of interesting things in it. Listen to what he says. I think you'll find it very familiar. And we'll be back after this.
What is this war for and how does it fit in? Number one, it keeps Americans terror stricken, which is cause for martial law to keep a civilian submission. How Christian, Mr. W? On to number two, it makes a major move towards one world religion. Number three, keeps peace in the Middle East, but really he's rebuilding a global one world system. The unseen prison, only for sheep to live in, overseen by global police with tracking chips in them. Quit laughing, they've been staging this for a minute. Who controls the global banks, controls the system we live in. Voting makes us think we have an opinion. Vote to make a difference. Vote for one or two hands on the same puppet singing. Singing. And the singing. Bombs bursting in air. Gave through to the night that the devil's still here. Deny it, turn cold shoulders or play dumb. Mainstream news is whitewashing tons. Wake up, 9/11 was made up by the same gov who trained Bin Laden and our CIA, the same nation. We flew them away from after the plane struck. They've won an excuse to wage war on our civilization. Unlawful gun confiscation made us give up our rights in exchange for freedom. We don't need them. All I see in false God preaching all lies, speaking pawn lies. TV's demon, crawl high, terror thrives. I've seen Jesus, I believe it's a time to die. Come on, I'll lead us with a weapon of mass destruction. Create plagues like bird flu to distract his actions. I hope to be back after the next massive attack comes. Signing off, Solar, and this is Patriot Act 1.
Hope you liked it. I found it interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely.
So, there's a lot to chew on in that song. And once again, though, just to I know I've done this in a previous podcast, but it's obviously going to sound a little different because we're both talking through one mic. If you would like to hear it sound better, please come to my website and hit the donate tab. And we will buy two microphones sufficient to prevent this kind of quality from happening again.
And we don't have to smell each other's breath.
Yeah. So, the title of this podcast is What is the War For? And that's exactly what the guy started out on with his verse. He asked, what is this war for? You know, I hear a lot of opinions about what the war in Iraq and various other wars were all about. You know, there's always an opinion. And let's just cover some of the basics. Like, I hear that it's a war so that we fight them here so we don't have to fight them there. Oh, we fight them there so they don't have to fight them here.
Which is, I think, it's very kind of us to choose the country we want to destroy in order to avoid a conflict on our own soil. If that is the case, it seems morally questionable at best to say that as Americans, we can take our war wherever we want.
Yeah, exactly. I have to totally agree with you on that one. And, you know, and then what's another one? Okay, so we hear that we fight them there, so we don't have to fight them here. What do you hear? It's oil.
Oh, yeah. That's the blood for oil.
Yeah.
That's been slightly there in the background all along, but it comes and goes. It's something you hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably I guess on the liberal side of things, that's what you hear mostly.
Yeah, pretty much. I have to admit, being more on the liberal side of things than Carl, that's one of the things I hear. Although, honestly, Yeah, I do hear that, but only incidentally does it feel like it's about oil. It seems like it's about money, which happens to coincide with oil right now.
Mm-hmm. And I also hear it's about the United States and the continuation of this idea that we're going to spread our democracy across the world by the barrel of a gun, if necessary.
Yeah. Thank you. It's wonderful, wonderful for us to impose our idea of how government should be on poor other countries that don't yet know how beautiful our democracy can be, right? that reason makes me ill. That's actually one of the ones I hear the most, is it's really, there's this deluded idea that we're somehow making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. And I also hear that the war in Iraq is simply the continuation of a totalitarian society, which America is, you know, that it's kind of the polar opposite of spreading democracy. We're actually imposing slavery. And sometimes you see that combined with other things like the making money thing. Like, we're going over there because we want to absorb the natural resources. You know, there's this idea of peak oil that's been going around. Peak oil basically believes that we're basically running out of oil.
Right.
And so our government, our United States, which consumes the majority of the oil in this country, I think we consume more oil than 23 other countries or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, something outrageous. And is clinging to the last reserves that remain.
Which is such a short-sighted reason to basically throw the entire world into total peril and danger, is basically so some people can live well for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it anyway.
So, and I'm sure Justin has his opinion about the wars for, and we're going to, you know, what the war is about, and we're going to hear about that. I also have my own opinions. I believe I have certain, I have read certain things that have caused me to believe that the war is about, it does, though many of those have an element of truth to it, I think there's about something much more significant going on behind all of this. The real reason behind why we're going to war in Iraq. I've talked to a lot of different people. I've listened to a lot of people talk about it. And I don't think I've ever heard anybody say this. So, if anything, if you don't agree with me, at least you're going to hear something new tonight.
Yeah. And just for the record, I've become so disillusioned over the last however many 6 years, 5 years, whatever it's been, and I'm starting to think it's about nothing. It literally feels like it's a war about nothing, and that no matter what happens, it's going to continue. If we have fewer casualties, well, let's send more troops in. Things are going well. If we have more casualties, let's send more troops in because things aren't going well. It feels like, I don't know how it started, but it's something that's going to continue. It's like a feedback loop for no reason and for nothing. That's my jaded opinion right now.
I hear you. And I think a lot of people are coming to that conclusion themselves. You know, as time goes on and we keep hearing that we're having progress, like certain people, of course. There's always, you know, both sides of the argument, which I got to say personally, and this is just my viewpoint, I don't really give a damn about either of those views because they're both coming from the position of I'm Democrat, I'm Republican. If I'm a Republican, then the war is going well. I'm optimistic. We are causing real change and good for that society. And if it's from the other side of the, you know, thing, it's like everything is evil as long as a Republican did it.
What do you mean?
Well, it just seems like, you know, there was a lot less anger towards Bill Clinton when he went into Kosovo.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They always talk about peace, this, peace, that. But when it comes to a Democrat, Democrats have a huge history of military action in the name of democracy.
Yeah, I don't think you could say the Democratic Party is a peace party. It's an anti-this war party, maybe,
right,
at best.
Well, I think if it's unpopular, or, you know what I'm saying, I guess the thing is, it's like it's always the opposite side of the spectrum that's doing what's wrong. And you know what I'm saying? That's what it seems like.
Yeah, but some, you know, that definitely might be true. There's some points where truth happens to overlap with, you know, these kind of preset ways that the two sides are going to go at each other. And, you know, right now I feel like it's closer onto the left side than the right. The truth happens to be a little bit more over there. I'm definitely, you know, to get topical for a second, more afraid of like a John McCain than anyone else as a president coming up.
Yeah.
You know, more afraid of.
Yeah. Well, I from my perspective, I think that I'm equally afraid of all of them. For example, you have you know, Clinton, which frightens me to death because of what Bill did while he was in office, and he, you know, they're totally hell bent on destroying our government. As far as I'm concerned, they want a socialist government, and I'm not a socialist. So, and no disrespect to socialists out there, you're totally cool with me. I just, my opinions about politics is that socialism is basically surrendering to the elite, and we'll get into that later on, as course, as I share my opinions about things. But let's just get into the information. But Obama, he just, I guess, one of his biggest backers, and one of the people I think is going to probably end up in the White House again, which frightens me to death, is this guy, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Well, we'll see. I mean, there's whispers about that. I don't know that there's a heck of a lot of, like, evidence for too many actual conversations between them, but I have heard that.
Yeah. And, you know, I well, let's talk about Zbigniew Brzezinski, because, like I said, I have a different opinion about what the war is about. And I think in Zbigniew Brzezinski, to me, Bill, he is, how do I phrase this correctly? He is basically, as far as I'm concerned, the person who is the most influential source on international or on foreign affairs. Basically, our foreign policy. He is considered the foreign policy guru of our country. And, you know, some may be shocked, but he was advocating going into the Middle East in the 80s, back then.
Now, just out of curiosity, do you think he's influential in the sense that these are his ideas and that they've come to pass? Or do you think, in a way, he just saw a little bit farther ahead of what was going to happen? What do you think about that?
Say the question.
Well,
again.
Like basically, do you think there are some people and they write about things that end up happening in 20 or 30 years mm-hmm. because they could see how things were going, and there are some people who write about how they want things to be, and then people make those things. They bend the will of the world more or less to make those things happen. Do you have an opinion if he's more someone who saw what was coming or someone who made what was coming?
Well, I don't think. I think it's a little bit of both and neither at the same time. Mm. In the sense that he is a policy shaper. When he wrote his book, and I'm going to read quotes from this book, The Grand Chessboard. The Grand Chessboard basically was his plead, I guess you can say his it was him writing down his views in a book for the intellectual elite of this country to try to convince them to go along with his policy. And it was extremely successful. I mean, it was, and I got to admit, you know, I read the book, and for a second there, it sounded like it was, you know, he's not a dumb guy.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's not dumb. I disagree with him for other reasons, and they're more moral-based. This guy, I don't know what his motivations are, and I'm not going to assume to know what he is motivated by. But, if you read his book, basically, he looks at things from a very aggressive standpoint. He knows a lot about foreign policy. Now, he either, one, is somebody who believes things are going a certain way, and he is really doing what's in the best benefit of the country to try to get the country to be more aggressive against a world that's becoming increasingly hostile. Okay? And that's kind of the idea that you get behind the book when he writes it. Or he has another motivation, and it's not based upon what you perceive that book to be. What that motivation is, you can draw your own conclusions. I have mine. And I think that there's a degree of arrogance and a degree of elitism that comes through in the book that I think is pretty revealing, because somebody who comes from that perspective, if he's really loving, like if this guy is just really caring about our country and the people in it, I don't think he would refer to them in the or reference them in the way that he does in this book, for example.
It's odd because I think it comes to a basic question of what would he mean by caring for our country? What is the country? And it's probably something divorced from the people at all. I doubt he gives much of a thought to what the human cost would be to any of these policies or ideas.
And see, I always got to make a distinction between what's my opinion and what's fact. Okay, this is not fact. This is my opinion. My opinion is that he does weigh the costs. He literally does not care, because his motivation is not on behalf of the people. It's on something else, and I'm going to get into what that is.
Yeah, I think I actually agree with you. I wasn't definitely not trying to say he's unaware of the cost, but some people, you know, if your end has to do with, you know, the way a country turns out or something that's for an elite or any small group of people, and you only have their interests in mind, then it's not gonna, you might know what the costs are for anyone else, but it's not gonna matter.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're worth it, I guess.
Right. Well, let's get into some stuff about Zbigniew Brzezinski, because I love him so much. Okay, now this is coming off a website for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And this is their breakdown of Zbigniew Brzezinski. They reference that center for Strategic International Studies as CSIS. So when you hear that, you know what they're referring to themselves. Zbigniew Brzezinski is a CSIS counselor and trustee and co-chairs the CSIS Advisory Board. He is also the Robert E. Osgood Professor of American Foreign Policy at the School of Advanced International Studies, Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. He is a co-chair of the American Committee for Peace in the Caucasus and is a former chairman of the United Ukrainian Advisory Committee. He was a member of the Policy Planning Council of the Department of State from 1966 to 1968, chairman of the Humphrey Foreign Policy Task Force from in the 1968 presidential campaign, director of the Trilateral Commission from 1973 to 1976, and principal foreign policy advisor Jimmy Carter in the 1976 presidential campaign. From 1977 to 1981, Dr. Brzezinski was national security advisor to President Carter. In 1981, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom for his role in normalization of the U.S.-China relations and for his contribution to the human rights and national security policies of the United States. He was also a member of the President's Chemical Warfare Commission in 1985, the National Security Council Defense Department Commission on Integrated Long-Term Strategy from 1987 to 1988, and the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board from 1987 to 1989. In 1988, he was co-chairman of the Bush National Security Advisory Task Force, and in 2004, he was co-chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force that issued the report Iran, Time for a New Approach. Dr. Brzezinski received his BA and MA from McGill University in 1949 and 1950, respectively, and a PhD from Harvard University in 1953. He was a member of the faculties of Columbia University from 1960 to 1989 and Harvard University from 1953 to 1960. He holds honorary degrees from Georgetown University, Williams College, Fordham University, College of the Holy Cross, Alliance College, the Catholic University of Lublin, Warsaw University, and Vilnius. How do you say it? Vilnius?
Vilnius.
I don't know how to say it. University. He is the recipient of numerous honors and awards. His many books include, and get this, Second Chance, Three Presidents and the Crisis of American Superpower, The Choice, Global Domination and Global Leadership,
or Global Leadership,
The Geostrategic Triad, Living with China, Europe, and Russia, The Grand Chessboard, what we're going to be talking about tonight, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives, and The Grand Failure, The Birth and Death of Communism in the 20th Century. But wait, they left out one book, because I have it, and it is called Between Two Ages, and we're going to get into that book on the next podcast a little bit. I'm not going to talk about it on this podcast, because it really has nothing to do with the war, but we're going to definitely talk about that book in the future, because if you want to understand where Zbigniew Brzezinski is actually coming from as his own personal views, that book is what tells you it.
Why would they leave it out?
I don't know.
Is there anything else they left out? Anything major?
Not that I'm aware of, just that book. That book was his first one, I think, actually. It was printed, I think it was done in 1987, so it's shortly before the last book they mentioned there, which was in 1989. But that book that he wrote was basically his own views. It wasn't a foreign policy book in the sense that most of these books here are trying to pitch an idea to the intellectual elite of this country. You know, you can tell by the title, you know, the Geostrategic Triad, Living with China, Europe, and Russia, the Grand Chessboard, the Grand Failure, you know, the Global Leadership. I mean, all these key terms. He's trying to basically give his opinion about certain foreign policy issues. Or his book, The Between Two Ages, talks about the oncoming technology age and the evolution of what our government is going to be, which he pretty candidly refers to it as socialism, which is coming for our future.
For America?
Yep. For most of the world, actually. He pretty much talks about the coming global world, which I'll get into it another time. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag on this one yet. That's good. So yeah, this guy has clout. I mean, listen to what this guy has done in his lifetime.
Through from administration after administration in an unbroken line, regardless of party,
right.
It looked like. Well, no, actually, now was he involved in the Clinton administration? There's a big gap between Bush and Bush.
Not that I'm aware of. And I think that he's basically more retired these days. Mm-hmm. I think after, you know, the first Bush, he kind of just backed off.
Right.
And he's getting kind of old now. I was watching an interview with him recently, and I was just like blown away because like the 5 years ago, I mean, he looked totally different, mm-hmm. and you can just tell he's aging.
Right.
And you know, they can't do it forever, but someone's going to quickly move up and fill his shoes, I'm sure. You know, that's usually how these things play out. So, but you know, this guy's not a joke. You know, when he writes a book, everybody who deals in foreign policy in this country reads it. Not only that, you think this guy is in, you know, he's teaching. I mean, he's at how many universities? And he's teaching people who are going to become the future foreign policy shapers of mm-hmm. our country, his views. So the only thing about influence, this is influence. This is how you can create or not necessarily create, but you can definitely affect change. I mean, I think it goes without saying this guy – is going to have an effect.
Right.
So the question is it a good one or a bad one? You know, where is this guy coming from? And let's read some quotes from the Grand Chessboard, and we'll just talk about them. So it's kind of long. I'm going to stop here and there, and I'm just going to kind of skip around. These are not in a line. This is not all back-to-back. If it was, it would probably just blow your head off. But the quotes in itself are pretty intense, and I think that, you know, let them speak for themselves, but you know, just know that as I kind of pause, I'm breaking up what would be the entire course of the book, and then I'll talk about what he says in this book in reference to the war, the current war, and what I think is pretty much the smoking gun on mm-hmm. why this war is actually occurring. The last decade of the 20th century has witnessed a tectonic shift in world affairs. For the first time ever, a non-Eurasian power has emerged not only as the key arbiter of Eurasian power relations, but also as the world's paramount power. The defeat and collapse of the Soviet Union was the final step in the rapid ascendance of a Western Hemisphere power, the United States, as the sole and indeed the first truly global power. But in the meantime, it is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus also challenging America. The formulation of a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian geostrategy is therefore the purpose of this book. Let me emphasize that. What is the purpose of this book? To formulate a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian geostrategy. If you don't know what Eurasia is, go to look at a map. You know where Europe is. You know where Asia is. The part that comes together. What is that called? Middle East.
Oh, the Middle East. Okay.
That's Eurasia. It's everything from, you know, the part of Europe furthest to the east and the part of Asia furthest to the west and anything in between. Eurasia. The attitude of the American public toward external projection of American power has been much more ambivalent. The public supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Interesting, huh?
Hmm.
I find that very suspicious. I'll tell you why.
Yeah, we find that language in later documents as well.
Yeah. I find that very suspicious because, you know, he said that we would not have supported an engagement in World War II if it was not for Pearl Harbor. And here we are, 9/11 is kind of the trumpet blast, if you will, of war against the Middle East. And in some sense, I mean, for some population section of this country, it's against the entire Islamic world.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know a lot of people who see it as it was the Islamic world, kind of people with brown skin who don't speak Spanish. declaring war against us, basically.
Right. And, you know, what's really interesting about the whole thing is that, you know, anybody who has, you know, any, I would say, optimistic views about things would look at this war and say, okay, Iraq had nothing to do with this.
Right.
I mean, and I know some people may listen to this and go, oh my God, there they go again, they're liberal. No, I'm not liberal.
No, I hope that's not news to you.
Yeah, I hope to God
it's pretty well
not.
Established by now. It might have been news 4, 5, 6 years ago. It's not news anymore. It's fact.
Yeah. The Iraq, there is no links to Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is a very interesting topic, especially when you're dealing with Zbigniew Brzezinski, and I'll get to that in a second. But let's go through some more quotes. For America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia. What, it's a prize? Okay, just emphasizing that.
Yes,
prize.
Forgetting prize. That there's actual human beings who call it home.
Yeah. Now, a non-Eurasian power is preeminent in Eurasia, and America's global primacy is directly dependent on how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained. It gets better. I mean, it gets much, much better, okay? America's withdrawal from the world of, or because of a sudden emergence of a successful rival to us, and to us is emphasized by me, I'm just saying that, so a successful rival would produce massive international instability. It would prompt global anarchy. So his view is, if anybody is able to emerge who's capable of challenging our dominance over the world, it would prompt a global anarchy. Perhaps it's true. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, but let's continue. In that context, how America manages Eurasia is critical. Eurasia is the globe's largest continent and is geopolitically axial. A power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions. A mere glance at the map also suggests that control over Eurasia would almost automatically entail Africa's subordination, rendering the Western Hemisphere and the Oceania geopolitically peripheral to the world's central continent. About 75% of the world's people live in Eurasia, and most of the world's physical wealth is there as well, both in its enterprises and underneath its soil. Eurasia accounts for 60% of the world's gross national product and about 3/4 of the world's known energy resources. Mm-hmm. So, okay, now you're getting the impression here. It's about oil. That's what I would get from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let's continue, because I think he expands on that. It is also a fact that America is too democratic at home to be autocratic abroad.
I don't know that I agree with that, but go on.
This limits the use of America's power, especially its capacity for military intimidation. Never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy, but the pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion. Well, obviously. I mean, it's a, you know,
really.
I mean, I thought popular passion is kind of a, you know, I mean, in order for you to have a power like that, we couldn't be a democracy.
Yeah, it's power over the popular passions. Never mind. I was going to say no one willingly submits to that, but apparently I'm wrong.
But the pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion, except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenge to the public's sense of domestic well-being.
This just makes me mad. I just want to go, when I hear this. I don't even have a coherent reaction, honestly.
You know, and I think that's the truth, man. As long as America's domestic well-being is not being threatened, they typically let anything happen.
Well, fortunately, we've been threatened, or we've been able to feel threatened ever since 9/11. I don't think we've ever been at a, what's the nicest code we can be at now, green or something? As if somehow there'll be no threat around the world. Don't think we're ever going to get there.
Yeah. This is. I mean, I'm just have to take breaks here and there because it really does piss me off, this the stuff that he writes. The economic self-denial, that is, defense spending, and the human sacrifice, casualties even among professional soldiers, required in an effort are uncongenial to democratic instincts. You know, no shit. Democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization.
I don't know what that word means, I'll be honest.
Inimical means it cannot be, cannot coexist.
Oh, okay, thanks.
You're either democratic or you're military power.
Okay, got it.
So basically, in order for us to be a military power, we cannot be democratic. What does that tell you? That sound good to you? I mean, I didn't think I decided to sign away my rights to him anyway.
But no.
Two basic steps are thus required. First, to identify the geostrategic dynamic Eurasian state. Two basic steps are thus required. First, to identify the geostrategically dynamic Eurasian states that have the power to cause a potentially important shift in the international distribution of power, and to decipher the central external goals of their respective political elites and likely consequences of their seeking to attain them. Second, to formulate a specific U.S. policies to offset, co-opt, and or control the above. So what does that mean? How would you offset, co-opt, and or control a nation?
Oh, you'd ask nicely, I'd hope.
Yeah, it's done by, meetings and signing.
That's so many words.
Peace treaties
and
stuff.
It's so many words just to say, find out who can get in your way and make sure that they're not a threat anymore by basically bombing them. Well, I mean, that's what it amounts to.
It's assassination. It's getting rid of the powers of a country.
Right.
You either control them, prevent them, do something that prevents them from being able to rise to power, or what else was it?
Which is so funny because you always hear, I mean, Bush is president now, so he's the one you hear say it. he's always so happy about the sovereign nations we're helping to create. Yeah. I wonder what sovereign even means in this kind of context. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing how there's no meaning to the words that are said, or opposite meanings.
Mm-hmm. And let's recap here. He basically said that we need to create a strategy in Eurasia to prevent anybody from rising to power to challenge us. He then mentioned the fact that there's oil there and lots of money. He then went into the fact that we have to control nations. Oh, no. First, he said that we have to get rid of democracy in order for there to be a military power. That which I assuming, you know, when he, you know, if he gets get into reading it, it would have to occur before he could actually get to a point where he could co-opt a nation.
Which also, I would also say the alleged doctrine of preemption is basically alluded to. It's kind of prophesied here at the end of that last quote. Formulate specific U.S. policies to offset, co-opt, and or control. I mean, what is that but our alleged preemption?
Right. It's basically saying, okay, if you have the power to challenge us, you're getting taken out.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And it's on the basis of what you could potentially become.
Yeah, not if you have challenged us. Simply being capable of challenging is a challenge.
Yeah, and not only that, not even being capable, becoming capable. What does that mean?
Being capable of becoming capable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being capable of becoming capable. Not that you are capable. Because the nations like China, which already are capable, we'll be getting into later on, because mm-hmm. he deals with them in a different way. So it's really interesting. To put it in terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together.
Is that, are we the barbarians?
I think it's pretty much anybody who's against his agenda. Right. I mean, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah,
the vassals, people who are on his side, to keep the tributaries pliant and protected, the people who are running the governments, keep them compliant with what he wants, and then keep them protected, so, you know, and prevent people who are against it from coming together to try to stop it.
I think the best possible, nicest way to read this is that the barbarians are everyone who are not Americans, and then I think the more realistic way to read it is the barbarians are everyone without the same agenda.
I think that would
Which was a much smaller amount, as we saw earlier.
Right. And you got to take into consideration, too, what we're seeing today, which is they're tapping phones or calling. I just saw a news report earlier that said that, Al-Qaeda in America look a lot like Western civilization people. Like, they don't look like they're, typical Islamic people. They're basically saying that they look just like everybody else.
Yeah.
So how do you know? Who's Al-Qaeda?
As you all know, if you're not doing anything wrong, there's no problem if people are listening to you. So... That's my people I love would say, unfortunately.
So let's continue on, because this is fun. You know, we're loving this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Henceforth, the United States may have to determine how to cope with regional coalitions that seek to push America out of Eurasia, thereby threatening America's status as a global power.
Mm.
Uzbekistan, nationally the most vital and most populous of the Central Asian states, represents the major obstacle to any renewed Russian control over the region. Its independence is critical to the survival of other Central Asian states, and it is the least vulnerable to Russian pressures.
Not a lot of Uzbekistan in the news, though, lately. Do you know right now what's the status of that? Is that still
It's a good question.
Is that still something that's really important?
I think that they're already independent. I think when you wrote this, they were not completely independent yet. And I'm not sure. But from my understanding, Uzbekistan has been, is independent from Russia. And actually, they're the first start point of the oil pipeline that goes through Afghanistan, from my understanding. They're a starting point on the way to the... I forget where it's going.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know to what extent they're propped up by us, if at all, or completely. I don't know. I'm just talking there. I'm curious.
No, I'm totally sorry. I have not researched it. I probably should get into it. I mean, obviously, it's big enough. It's important enough for him to mention it.
Yeah.
So we should probably look into it. So we'll do that. And we'll get back to you guys on a future podcast. And if we forget, remind us.
Yeah. I got lots of downtime at work to Google this stuff.
Moreover, the Central Asian Republics is what he's referring to, are of importance from the standpoint of security and historical ambitions to at least three of their most immediate and most powerful neighbors, namely Russia, Turkey, Iran, and China. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Russia, Turkey, and Iran, with China also signaling an increasing political interest in the region.
Which is long past come true. I think he would definitely rephrase that now.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're much more powerful now than they were at the time he wrote this. But the Eurasian Balkans are infinitely more important as a potential economic prize. An enormous concentration of natural gas and oil reserves is located in the region, in addition to important minerals, including gold.
Gold. At $1,000,000,000 an ounce.
And I always wonder, because, you know, it's not our government mining this stuff. I wonder who they're planning to get it to. I mean, obviously, he's looking at it as, like, we can absorb the wealth of that, but I don't want to... I mean, it's obviously not the government who does it.
No, probably not. I mean, to get on the more... I don't know if this is leftist sounding. Probably.
Maybe.
But it's definitely multinationals seem to replace anything looking like a one country.
No, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And see, I don't even think that, you know, that's a leftist idea. I just think that there's, you know, I think that's pretty much known.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I don't think that's – I mean, a person would be hard-pressed to argue that.
Yeah, I think the left kind of took over the word multinational, and you tend to mostly hear it from there. So when people hear it, they think.
Well, I think the idea is that they use it as evidence that capitalism doesn't work, and that's and since right is so free of market, this is their evidence that no, free markets don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into that.
Yeah,
I don't even want to make a comment on it, but I think that's what. But the fact that multinationals in our government, they do exist. I mean, they have the power. They're the ones that are seizing control of these things. I mean, look at what's going on with what's that company, Halliburton. I mean, Cheney, came from Halliburton, and I mean, multinationals have been in the government for quite a while now. The world's energy consumption is bound to vastly increase over the next two or three decades. Estimates by the U.S. Department of Energy anticipate that world demand will rise more than 50% between 1993, when he wrote this, and 2015, with the most significant increases in consumption occurring in the Far East. China.
China, yeah, definitely happened. China, India, too.
Mm-hmm. The momentum of Asia's economic development is already generating massive pressures for the exploration and exploitation of new sources of energy, and the Central Asian region and the Caspian Sea Basin are known to contain reserves of natural gas and oil that dwarf those of Kuwait, the Gulf of Mexico, and the North Sea.
Yeah. We have yet to start really hearing about that. I think that's on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see a lot of military action going on there eventually.
You don't hear Caspian Sea too often, but you might soon.
Uzbekistan is, in fact, the prime candidate for regional leadership in Central Asia. Huh. So we're going to have to look into Uzbekistan and find out what's going on there.
Yeah. If you got good sources, let us know. Because this is definitely important.
Mm-hmm. Once pipelines to the area have been developed, Turkmenistan's truly vast natural gas reserves augur a prosperous future for the country's people. Hmm. Well, that's good for them.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't take too many bombs killing them before they get it.
Yeah, I don't imagine that's how it's going to turn out.
No, I don't.
Call me crazy. But
once pipelines to the area have been developed, okay. In fact, an Islamic revival already abetted from the outside, not only by Iran, but also by Saudi Arabia, is likely to become the mobilizing impulse for the increasingly pervasive new nationalisms, determined to oppose any reintegration under Russia and hence infidel control. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting the phrase increasingly pervasive new nationalisms. Oh, I only say that because it seems to me like an American nationalism has really been increasingly pervasive in the world. I doubt that he would include that among what he's talking about here, but
good point.
It seems it's nationalism on the quote right side seems like the only real way to pull this off.
Mm-hmm. For Pakistan, the primary interest is to gain geostrategic depth through political influence in Afghanistan and to deny to Iran the exercise of influence in Afghanistan and Tajikistan and to benefit eventually from any pipeline construction linking Central Asia with the Arabian Sea. Turkmenistan has been actively exploring the construction of a new pipeline through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Arabian Sea.
I wonder if anything ended up standing in their way for a little while there. Perhaps.
Yeah, maybe
Afghanistan?
Like a...
yeah. Never fear.
No problem. It's all taken care of now. Yeah. It follows that America's primary interest is to help ensure that no single power comes to control this geopolitical space and that the global community has unhindered financial and economic access to it.
The global community, huh?
Well, this is different. A global community, because it's not just America. Yeah. I thought it was just America he was being imperial about.
No, we're all holding hands.
Wow, I wonder who's part of this. Obviously, they're not. Who is this global community?
Global meaning the rest of the globe.
Yeah.
Not that Eurasian part with the gigantic percentage of the entire population of the world in it.
Yeah. Maybe it's the coalition of the willing. You know? China's growing economic presence in the region and its political stake in the area's independence are also congruent with America's interest.
Yay!
China!
We should have our Olympics there.
They're like, get off our turf, you know? I mean, obviously, China's growing. They're going to need some oil.
I love how, if you really look at it, in reality, our new kind of open arms approach to China just happens to coincide with the fact that we need them, not any change in their government, really, whatsoever, not any change in the way they treat people. Just the fact that they're way more convenient if they keep doing what they're doing. Now we welcome them with open arms.
Absolutely.
We have our Olympics there.
Yeah. It's going to be fun, too.
Mm, I'd boycott. I know it's easy for me to say because I can't run a mile, but there's no way I'd be in those Olympics.
Yeah. It's really sad. That's a whole nother topic.
Yeah,
it just really bothers me. There's no country. Let me just say it for the record, and this is not racist. I have no problem with Chinese people. I have a problem with China.
The country of, which, of course, I'm sure is not a real friend to the Chinese people anyway.
No, I mean, yeah. Yeah, you can't read the books you want to read, do the things you want to do. Like, you can't even get on YouTube.
Come on.
Because there's stuff on there that's anti-Chinese. I read the other day, and I didn't know this, but I'm not surprised. I mean, I heard that they're forced to take a class on patriotism and swear an allegiance to the country that says, I love China. Oh, God. You know what I'm saying? Like, are you serious? How can you force people to make to proclaim that they love a nation when they don't want to? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not even a real. I mean, what do they? I don't even understand how these people think. But what do they think they are gaining from that? You know?
Like, yeah, but who listening doesn't feel like we're not just inching ever closer to that?
Yeah. Here. I mean, yeah, it's scary. America is now the only global superpower. And Eurasia is the globe's central arena. Hence, what happens to the distribution of power on the Eurasian continent will be of decisive importance to America's global primacy and to the America's historical legacy. Now, you're getting kind of the summary of the whole book, and then I want you to pay more attention to what he says here than any other stuff that we've read, because this basically exposes his foreign policy perceptions and why he said all this stuff before. And, you know, you got to look at it. The name of this book is The Grand Chessboard. You have to look at it from the perspective of somebody who looks at the world like a chessboard. I mean, he literally looks at the world like a chessboard. You think, what is the person I'm playing against here, my opponent, you're trying to think, you know, 2, 3, 4, as many as you can steps ahead and trying to plan accordingly, right? That's how you win the chess game, by positioning your pieces and then attacking.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind. The question is, who are we attacking? What is this all about? Is it just to seize the oil? You know? We'll see. Without sustained and direct American involvement, before long the forces of global disorder could come to dominate the world scene. And the possibility of such a fragmentation is inherent in its geopolitical tensions, not only of today's Eurasia, but of the world more generally.
So
basically what he's saying there is, if we don't do this, we're going to be screwed. Everyone's going to be screwed. We're doing it for everyone's benefit.
I'm curious. That seems to imply a certain... He has a real basic understanding of the nature of people that definitely doesn't allow for people to make really their own decisions. Or he doesn't seem to believe that people could act on their own in any way.
Right.
To me, that's what it seems like.
Yeah. And I think this goes along with what I'm going to be getting into with other things. I believe these people I refer to in past podcasts view things from the perspective, and this is a philosophic understanding, that there are some people who are just more intelligent, and there's some people who are just straight dumb. And the people who are dumb cannot have positions of power because they are not responsible with them. And that, therefore, the solution to world peace is the confiscation of power from anybody who's not worthy. Mm-hmm. By any means necessary, which then causes death and destruction and yada yada, mm-hmm. and lack of freedom and people's free will. And which is exactly what they claim to be helping us for.
Right. It's interesting. I don't think anyone, in a sense, disagrees. No one wants an idiot ruler,
right.
I don't think. But it's interesting. In whose hands do you stick the role of defining what intelligent versus non-intelligent is? What does that really mean?
Mm-hmm. And even more fundamental than that is the question, like, you know, even if somebody has their own perception of what's the best interest in mind, and perhaps it is the best, why is his idea of what's best going to be the one that actually happens, and not the person, say the Christian, who wants to convert everybody to Christianity by the force of a gun,
mm-hmm.
who will do that. He'll kill you if you do not convert to Jesus Christ, just like they did in, you know, the Catholic Church did at one time. You know, and their idea, that to them, they were forming their utopian world. They were going to accomplish what they thought was the best of mankind. They were trying to save people, man. And why is this any different?
Yeah, why?
You know, like, and what makes it different?
And in some way, how is it any different than the boogeyman that they paint of the Islamic extremist who's trying to take our freedoms away and hates us so much? I mean, it's one of those classic cases of projection where basically they're taking what applies to them and just pretending that it actually applies to someone else, when it's actually they're talking about themselves.
Yeah. But, you know, of course, everybody is an angel in their own eyes, mm-hmm. right? So what can you say? You know, and it's so elitist. You know, it really is. It's an elitist mentality. When I try to think of what elitism is, it's this idea that you know better than everybody else. And it's so blinding. Like, you're incapable of seeing the effect of your own arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
You're incapable of it. It's just because you think that you have it figured out. And it's really difficult to – you know how it is. You talk to people who think they got it all figured out, and they're not willing to, like, bend in the slightest bit.
Mm-hmm.
They are the truth, man. And there's no change in their mind. With warning signs on the horizon across Europe and Asia, any successful American policy must focus on Eurasia as a whole and be guided by a geostrategic design. That puts a premium on maneuver and manipulation in order to prevent the emergence of a hostile coalition that could eventually seek to challenge America's primacy. It's required, man. You have
China,
to do
China, Russia, maybe. Yeah,
maybe. Well, who else could it be? I mean, we were talked about Iran, and you know, but you know,
it's not going to be China, India. It's going to be China, someone.
It's going to be China, someone. And here you got, you know, which is really interesting because here you have a little tag team going on between Iran, China, and Russia. I mean, China is helping Russia out quite a bit, from what I understand, and because of that, Iran is being very helpful to China and Russia as far as fuel's concerned.
They're
forming a little team there because they kind of see what's happening, I'm sure. I mean, we'll get this. You can get this book at any freaking bookstore. You know what I'm saying? So, like, it's not like he's keeping it a secret. Yeah. This is not top secret stuff. The average citizen in America is too busy watching American Idol to read it.
It's not an easy read either.
No, it's not.
You've got to really focus.
Yeah. I mean, and this is only sections of the book. I mean, can you imagine the depth of everything else? And I got to say, he does present a compelling case. He does. If you're immoral and you have this view of things like he does, like the world's a grand chessboard.
If the world was, in fact, a chessboard, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, it didn't require... You know, I just look at it, it's like, it's a grand chessboard. The only two people playing are the elitists. One elitist view against another. You know what I'm saying? And it's the people who are going to end up getting paid for it, because it's not them standing on the front lines. It's the soldiers who don't know anything about foreign policy and are convinced that they're doing what's in the best interest of their country, and that goes for all countries. And that's the sad part, you know? And you know, when it's all said and done, you know, whoever dies, whatever pawns get taken out, and, you know, you got a few things here. The king and queen is really the guy who's moving the chess pieces.
Yeah.
You know, not the people you see on the board. So it doesn't matter who gets taken out as long as their agenda is accomplished. Let's see here. The most immediate task is to make certain that no combination of states gains the capacity to expel the United States from Eurasia or even diminish significantly its decisive arbitration role. In the long run, global politics are bound to become increasingly uncongenial to the concentration of hegemonic power in the hands of a single state. This is where it's really revealing. In the long run, global politics are bound to become increasingly uncongenial to the concentration of hegemonic power in the hands of a single state. What does that mean? Hence, America is not only the first, as well as the only truly global superpower, but is likely to be the very last. Mm. Where's it going to go? As long as there's separate countries, there's always going to be a world power, or multiple world powers, but there's going to be world power, and it's going to be conflict. The only solution, naturally, would be what?
My only guess would be, I would suppose it would have to look like there wasn't, but that there actually would somehow... there would be something that actually was, in a way, a central power, even though it didn't look like there was. That's my only guess.
Or perhaps all the countries would unite into one country.
Oh, I guess that's possible.
Because then there's no war. I mean, if you're all one world government, I mean, who are you going to go to war against?
Yeah.
Mars? You know, like, you're a world power. And obviously, if the big fish all teamed up, I mean, it would be easy to eat the little fish. What are they going to do? They don't have nuclear weapons. They don't have technology. They don't have economy. They don't have anything. I mean, they could easily take these countries out. Easily.
Well,
I mean,
yeah. You'd think so,
people
then,
might rise up, but you know, they have the ability to suppress masses of people. Obviously.
You say easily, but then you look at Afghanistan. I mean, we haven't had an easy job of it there.
But the thing is, they're not really trying to seize the people. The people, they don't care about the people. They care about the government and the power and the money. You know what I'm saying? They have that. They just don't have the people supporting it. And I guess that's what it all boils down to, is like, if they were to create this global government, the question is, are the people going to submit to it, or are they going to rise against it? And I'm sure there's going to be people rising against it. And, you know, but the problem is you take America, for example. America is the prime example of what, if you dump a bunch of money into a civilization and food, how fat and stupid people will become, because they're just comfortable. And I mean, I'm not saying that because I hate America or anything. I love America. But It's kind of depressing to see what's happening to this country. You know, like, I remember I've been doing stuff for campaigning for Ron Paul. And I was at the booth, you know, talking to people all day, you know, every Thursday night at the farmer's market. And it was just unbelievable, the stuff that people don't know. I mean, it was like I would have conversations with people, and I could tell that they really didn't know the difference between a Republican or a Democrat. Other than that, the Democrats were against the war and the Republicans are for it. Mm. I mean, that was it. And these are people who are supposed to vote to make sure that the power of their government doesn't get into the wrong hands. It can be really discouraging, you know what I'm saying? And I found myself, more than anything, giving people an education on politics, which, you know, of course you can only do so much of when you're sitting there trying to talk to people, you know. But, and, you know, I just think that if the people, like he said in the previous statement, if people's domestic well-being is not threatened, you can do almost anything you want. The only thing that I think that would stop that is perhaps religious zealousness, which you'll get with Islam and maybe other. Maybe, I don't know if other religions will jump on board, but certainly that one.
Which is a large enough contingent.
Right, and we're tackling that baby right now, aren't we?
Yeah, but...
You know, I mean, if that one gets out, I mean, I don't know who else is going to rise up. I mean, the Chinese people are pretty much under control.
Hmm.
You know? I don't know, man. We'll see what happens. But for the last quote... Moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstances of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat.
Which, what isn't mentioned here, and I think is, it might be in the book, but is kind of genius, is besides it being a truly massive threat, it's one that, in reality, there's no way to actually get rid of. There's no way that victory against it actually looks, so it can go on indefinitely.
Mm-hmm. And I do not doubt. I mean, okay, it's a big new Brzezinski. I'm just gonna. This is just upon hunch. I would bet you, and I'm no, it's not hunch. Let me rephrase that. I've read his other book. I know what this guy believes. Okay, he's a humanist, and he believes. He didn't say he didn't believe in God, but most humanists don't. They believe in some kind of abstract idea of God, and man, and basically the destiny of man is in man's hands, and when we get into his other book, it'll show you more about what he believes. And if you ever want to take the time to find it, I don't know if you can find it in a library, but it's called Between Two Ages. And I do not doubt that, you know, that I don't think that any religion is going to be immune from becoming the target of this agenda. It doesn't matter if you're Islamic or Buddhist or anything. It doesn't matter what you are. If there's a sudden emergence of people who are against the agenda, regardless of what they belong to, whether it's a race, class, you know, religion, political party, anything, it could easily become the target, the new terrorism.
Mm-hmm. But it's all going to be called terrorists.
Yeah, they're all terrorists.
It's going to be like there'll be a long unbroken line of just of faceless threat that's all called terrorists.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. It's a slippery slope we're walking, allowing this stuff to happen, and it's kind of scary the way things are going because as time goes on, the classification for terrorism seems to be ever widening. I mean, to the point now that podcasts like this could become a subject of terrorism.
Sure.
In the eyes of the government. I mean, the way they are so abstract in the way they define it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, easily. Because, well, what was it? There was a quote. What was it? If anybody means to bring about change in people, they didn't specify what kind of change, just change in people, whether it be political, religious, or anything else. Like, you could even be a Christian just witnessing Christ to people, and you could be considered a terrorist by the government according to their classification.
Hmm.
You could be a Democrat trying to get a Republican to become a Democrat, and you're a terrorist. I mean, based upon their perception, but even more so, here we are talking about this stuff. I mean, unbelievable, you know? And anybody, as far as there's concern, as far as what the law says now, you can be a terrorist. You know, we haven't seen a whole lot of that, but then again, I don't suppose that they're going to just come, you know, they're going to show live footage of them coming in and taking innocent people out, in, you know, in handcuffs. So, I don't know. So that's it. That's it for the book. I would highly recommend, if you're intelligent enough and have a strong moral structure like I do. No, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't say not so much.
Smart as Carl.
No, not so much as if I'm intelligent. I have a strong sense of morality that prevents me from falling for the logic of this book, because he's not a dumb guy. I mean, you don't become somebody in his position by being dumb.
No.
You know?
And the logic's not necessarily flawed. It just doesn't take into account as important something called, like, life. It doesn't take that into account as important. It takes it into account, but it doesn't put value on it.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Not as much as the goal, you know, by any means necessary, right? The ends justifies the means.
Yeah, and I would imagine any concern about loss of life would only be because it might, you know, dissuade the people from
exactly
from still yes. backing this idea.
Exactly. That's probably more or less what he's concerned with when he mm-hmm. mentions it, you know. And so, you know, what is this war for? And there's a lot of reading between the lines you have to do. He doesn't blatantly say it, but I'm going to give you my piece. The war is for many things, but most of all is the vision of a utopian society that I believe that these people are after. They're after this utopian vision. This vision has multiple facets to it, multiple aspects to it. But ultimately, it requires... And always there's connected the idea of world peace and indeed hunger and all those really fuzzy, happy things that we always dreamed of always seem to be incorporated with it in their own mind. Regardless, you know, of course, it doesn't include those people who are going to die in the process of making it happen. But, hey, it's a small sacrifice for the greater good. But the utopian vision is a global society. And the motivation is alleged to be all this peace and whatnot. And he is basically saying that in order for this to happen, they're going to have to take out some of the big fish, China, Russia, and Iran, and some of the other ones that are coming up. And we need to – and we have to deal with the people, the Islamics, which totally overrun that side of the world. And in order to apprehend – the one thing that causes governments to rise to power and to fall, which is the natural resources, specifically oil. That is what's dominating our industry. That's what caused America's growth. It is the fuel behind economy. And if the bulk of the world's fuel got into the wrong hands, you will see the emergence of a country that is capable of challenging our power and therefore stopping the agenda. And it cannot happen because it would prompt global chaos. Not to say that I'm on China's side, because I'm certainly not. I think they're a horrible country, and I think if they ever rose to power, it would be a horrible thing. And the fact that they already are rising to power is just bothering me, to say the least. I mean, I think most of that has to do with the fact that we're dumping tremendous amounts of money into them, allowing them to ship their goods over to our country, which I'll get into in a second, but... That's what I think it is. I think the purpose of this whole thing is that they need to seize the Middle East. They want to get permanent bases there for what's going to be the future of a conflict, the final war between Russia, China, and maybe a few other countries like Iran and so on, and to seize those countries so that we can create either they come along with the agenda, which so far they've been pretty much against. Does that sound like a pretty fair analysis?
Of the book?
Well, yeah.
Or of the future.
the book, the future and the book, you know, supporting that idea.
Definitely the book, and I hope not the future.
Yeah.
It's the hard part for me to imagine is if there is this war, you know, this kind of final war, quote unquote, it's still hard for me to imagine people agreeing to be under one banner, so to speak. That could just be short-sighted of me. Maybe there is a way, and maybe I just don't understand the scope of the war. What really is going to be targeted and, you know, possibly defeated? But it's so hard to imagine.
Right. Well, you probably didn't listen to the last podcast, but I had an interview with a guy named Chris, who is an archaeologist, and through him being an archaeologist, he's discovered that the United Nations is very much involved in what we do in our country. That he said that there's actually he asked, you know, what countries, what sovereign governments are in the United States? And well, of course, there's United States. There's tribal sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
but almost nobody will know this. But the United Nations is also considered a recognized sovereign nation within the United States.
Mm.
The treaties that we sign with them, things he talked about multiple aspects of it, but a lot of people don't know that we've already pretty much signed over our military. Our military goes and fights for the United Nations now, and these are foreign governments. You know, I don't see it being impossible for people to unite in the United Nations, especially if there was enough conflict in the world, enough death maybe or whatever, that it caused people to just be desperate for anything. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, torture. You know, if you want to get something out of somebody, you know, torture them for a while. They'll get it. You know, they'll admit to you things that they never even did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to get you to stop. And if the people are if the people are put under enough pressure and they don't have the education to understand the direction in which things are going, and they have a strong enough will or a solid belief that what is occurring is not something that they want to support, then I don't see them being able to withstand those pressures. Or more or less not even knowing that their pressures are because of this. Like, you know, if you were, you know, and he's talking about co-opting societies. Now, don't think for a second that he won't co-opt this one. Just because we're American, I don't think that he means just other countries or other nations. I think he would be perfectly willing to work within the United States as well, you know. I mean, to the point that now he's in his book, he's talking about basically eliminating the real essence of democracy for the sake of imperial mobilization. So even the fact that we're going to be, you know, working militaristically and co-opting other countries, as much as they're going to have to co-opt this one in the sense that we're going to be defending our democracy. I mean, he'd have to. It's essential. It would just, there's no way around it unless the people basically handed it up, which I kind of feel like to a degree we are. But I think I just don't see there being a limit to what they're willing to do. I mean, I don't feel like they're holding the value of a human life or my privacy or anything, even in this country, if they won't value the same type of, you know, a life in Iraq, like a child, you know, dying, big deal to them. You know, why would a child in this country die and mean any different?
The part that I can't see, and I'm not someone who sees what things are going to be like very well. I've never been like that. Some people are, you know, they're visionary, and that's definitely not me. And I guess the more I think about it, this just the possibilities are frightening. But I don't see what this kind of what kind of horror is going to have to fall on the world for this to happen. Because I feel like we're so far from the possibility right now that the level of horror is going to have to be so much greater than anything we've ever known for something like this to work. And that's frightening.
Yeah, it's absolutely frightening. I don't want to think about it, honestly. But, I mean, I do think about it, though. And, you know, it would have to be something intense. And what that would be, I don't know. I think for America, it would be a lot easier. I mean, America is a pretty spoiled nation. I mean, take away their lattes and they start crying. You know, I mean, I'm not, no offense to Americans, because I'm American, obviously, too. I drink lattes myself.
As do I.
I love them. But, I mean, let's get real here. We've been wealthy for a very long time. We enjoy the luxuries so much so that we rarely ask. I mean, there's a small percentage of the population that actually cares what has been done in order to get those luxuries to other people. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean,
I might not be wearing anything right now that wasn't in one way or another bought cheaply because of the blood of someone else. It's probably true. It's probably very true.
Same here. I'm not immune from that as well.
I didn't drive over here without the blood of who knows how many people, like, running in my car.
Yeah. So, it begs to ask, you know, you have to ask the question, you know, what is it going to take for America to give it up, basically, to give up their sovereignty, to give up their belief in democracy? I don't think it would take much for us.
I totally agree with that. I don't think it would take much because I think we've seen, if we haven't seen it happen already, then we've seen us getting really close to that edge. If you imagine it as an edge to fall over, we've leaned right over it if we haven't jumped off it.
I mean, that's basically what the war in Iraq is really powered on right now, as people's domestic well-being was threatened in a very small way because, I forget who it was that said this. But I think it was somebody in the Middle East in the government or something like that. I'm trying to remember who. But he said – he basically dismissed the horror that America was in. He said, yeah, it's bad. But we deal with this crap all the time. And you guys are – you know what I'm saying? You guys lost a few people. We've been doing this for years. Mm. We live in horror. Like, most of the world is living this way. Hello, you know? And he was basically looked down upon because how dare he say that about America? Because it was so much more important that we had been bombed.
Yeah.
You know, it would take a lot for other countries – I think, Although I think that, you know, if there was a little sharing of the wealth, you know, if they like prod them with money and say, hey, you can be like Camaro, you too can buy, you know, a Lamborghini and a Lexus and this and that, I think they would be really happy, and a lot of them would fall, especially the leaders. I mean, most people who are attracted to power already have a nature to them that I think is pretty suspicious.
Well, that I tend to think that as well. Like, anyone who can make it high up enough to actually qualify to run for president is and have a chance at it is probably someone you don't want babysitting your kids, Ellie.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and that's in America, where we actually have a democracy. And taking other countries as an example, you know, where they, you know, basically seize the government and it's, yeah, you know, theirs. You know, you're taking that into consideration. And, you know, I mean, you got countries where the leaders are basically handing land over to these corporations that don't even belong to them, just because they basically seize a couple of the major cities in the country, and all of a sudden the whole country is theirs. You know, and it's absurd.
Yeah, there are whole countries, and that is true. Tiny island countries here and there. The entire country, it's could basically be renamed, you know, Sony Land or something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and it's getting to be more and more that way as time goes on. I mean, it's only going to be a matter of time before most of the governments, if it hasn't been seized by our government specifically through military action, it certainly has been seized through our economy.
Yeah, and I think that's the real thing. I think, back to something you were saying before, I think basically what you're saying is the promise of making us all fat and happy consumers is right now maybe the best hope of uniting us all under one structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then if we ever decide to, you know, start rejecting the progression towards this, all you have to do is remove some of those lovely comforts that we've come so accustomed to and watch us just get all riled up. And of course, the solution would be naturally exactly what they wanted to accomplish in the first place. I mean, it's pretty easy. I mean, for America. What's scary, though, and I think this is the scariest, is because America holds – these people, America, probably hold in their hands the most potential for stopping such an agenda. And most are not aware, nor do most care. Most are more concerned over getting the next, you know, video game set that comes out or whatever. I'm not even following. I know there's like the Wii, you know.
I got a 360 for my birthday.
You're evil.
Hey, come on.
But, you know, there's people are more concerned about these things than they are about the fact that the luxuries that we exist on today are the byproduct of the misery of much of the world. And that fact, you know, it is scary because I feel like America is the last hope of the country, of the world. I mean, we're it. And our country is being used as the primary vessel through which an agenda such as this is being perpetuated.
What I'm hoping for, I don't know if I agree with that or not. What I'm hoping for is the possibility that whatever country this comes out of, that something like the ability for small areas to become energy independent from the rest of the world. Small areas, you know, a county, and then the county next to it's independent, even from that county or city or whatever. I'm hoping, I mean, you know, solar or whatever, I don't know. I'm hoping that there's the possibility of actual energy independence, and I wonder if that was ever, I wonder how Brzezinski considered that and what consideration he gives to that. I wonder if that's really something that could thwart a lot of this.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, the basic point about this podcast, and this is, you know, probably should be apparent to anyone who's been listening to it, is that there ain't a damn thing you're going to do about an agenda you don't know about. It's important that we realize that this stuff is occurring. Maybe you don't believe it in the way that I believe it. That's fine. But believe that – you read his book. This guy is deciding the future of your children and your children's children by his policies that he's influencing today. And we are in a dangerous age. As I said before, if Hitler was in control of our government today, he would have easily seized the world. Because the technology that exists, there is little hope for a people to stop it. I mean, the technology that exists today, I mean, you know, and it took a war and a lot of death in order to stop it. And, you know, today those countries, those huge, big, huge powers, that are going to come against any kind of power that would potentially, seize all the power in the world, is not existent. There's there that we are it, and they're working in our government. So what does that tell you? What's left? The people of this country. That's all that's left to stop it. And that's and what I'm seeing today. I would like to cling to hope of believing that someday, sometime soon, maybe enough domestic well-being will be challenged, and the people, something will happen that is abnormal for our country. That instead of us surrendering our sovereignty, or putting our tail between our legs and weeping because we don't have our warm latte in the morning, that the people will actually stand up and say enough is enough, and do something about it. But the only way that's going to happen is if you out there listening, me, myself, and everybody we know, and everybody throughout this country starts educating themselves, which means that you have to stop spending so much time being luxurious and living the life of luxury that we have here. Even the poorest people rock CD players. They have nice cars. I mean, I grew up in a hood. I mean, they all got nice. I mean, a lot of people, not all of them. I was probably the poorest in the neighborhood at one point, but there was a lot of people spending their money on stuff like this. They all had games, video games. They had their sack of weed. They had everything. We spend a lot of time making ourselves feel good, and it's intoxicating. It's an opiate. Prevents us from becoming knowledgeable and taking action against. I guess the bottom line, and I would hope, is that the real motivation would be some kind of moral, this belief that, life is precious, and that we should take into consideration the people that are suffering and stand up on their behalf, and not have to wait for ourselves to be threatened.
I don't know. You're more positive sounding than I would ever be about it. I have no hope for that, personally. I don't see the possibility, unless it's our own, kids who are forced to work, or who are our own loved ones who are dying or being maimed in factories or whatever. I don't see it.
Yeah.
I might be wrong. Again, I said I'm no visionary. I'm definitely not. And I've been proven wrong a million times.
Yeah.
So hopefully I'm wrong about this.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll happen. I can only hope. And that's what we'll leave you with. Hope. Hopefully, you and everybody else that you know, maybe you'll enlighten some people onto the facts. Maybe you haven't been convinced that this is what the war is really all about, or you still believe it's some kind of divine thing that is occurring to spread democracy or whatever. I don't know where you're coming from if you're listening to this, but, hopefully, it's not what I think it is. And even more so, if it is, I hope that somebody does something to stop it. Okay, so I don't know where to go from here. I'm getting tired now.
That's a fine place to stop.
Okay, well, we will come back with another podcast. So basically, this is our idea, guys. I know I've said this in the past. I'm sorry. I keep saying, I'm going to keep doing these podcasts. I'm going to keep putting them out. I'm going to try to do one every month. I even one time even had the audacity to say I'm going to put one out every 2 months. Two a month. I just,
Still, we're on number 10. That's pretty good. I mean, what's it been, a year and a half? Or has
it's
it been,
been it's been over 2 years now.
No way.
Has it?
I no, so. I did the first one with you. It was like
no, you didn't do the first one.
Oh, I didn't.
No, I had three or four
Never
podcasts
mind.
Before you.
I was wrong.
This is number 10. We did four together.
Oh.
So, So, anyways, we are... Or I should take personal responsibility because I'm the one that started this. I have said that we're going to try to be consistent. So this is actually going to be an effort. Now that Justin's back and, I have more accountability. When he was around, I was kicking him out faster, obviously. We're going to try to do this once a month. And even more so, we are going to try to, at one point, try to take questions. I'm going to try to figure out a phone thing. And we're going to get on StickCam. And we're going to do it live so you can actually watch it live. And ask questions and things of that sort as it's going on StickCam. We have a little chat room. It's on the website. And we're probably going to do it I'll post it on the website when I finally do the announcement. So keep your eyes peeled for that. But I'm thinking probably the first Sunday night of every month. would be a good way to. You think that's okay?
Yeah, that's probably going to work.
Okay. Well, I'll post it when it's official, just in case.
It might fluctuate back and forth a week here and there, depending. Sorry. It might vary a little, but I think that should work.
Yeah. So that's what we'll shoot for. And also, you'll notice that I updated the site. Basically, the reason I updated it is because it was feeling a little dreary and dark for me. You know, I just thought to myself, it's starting to look a little bit like InfoWars or something, you know? And it was not the way that I wanted to convey myself, because that's really, I'm a lot more hopeful than, you know, I don't want it to be a scary website. Ooh, I want it to be an informative website. And so I updated it. I made it more professional, and it's actually laid out quite a bit different. Just tinker around with it. You'll figure it out. And I'm actually working on forming a virtual library, which is going to take a long time for me to do because I really don't have a whole lot of time for those types of things. But I'll do my best, and I'll just keep updating it section at a time. Just kind of check it here and there. Don't check it too frequently because it's probably not going to happen quickly. And I'll be adding things like books that you can read online and pictures and information about people, so you can start studying the stuff and have references to works. And see if I'm correct. Like I always say, don't believe me. Go read it for yourself, and see what conclusion you come up with, and then come share it with me. And hopefully, you know, or not hopefully, maybe we'll have the same opinion. And if we don't, it would be interesting to share with you and see what you got from it. So, all right, everybody, truthleftfreedom.org. This is So Real signing out. Justin,
see you later.
Till next time.